Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. How healthy are North Texas kids? Each year, Children's Health releases Beyond ABC. It's a report that looks at the quality of life for children in North Texas. And the picture this year has some surprises, from teen pregnancy rates to asthma and obesity. We're talking this hour with a pair of doctors who helped write the report. Dr. Anu Partap is assistant professor of pediatrics at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and Dr. Ray Tsai is president and chief medical officer with Children's Health Pediatric Group. Dr. Partap, Dr. Tsai, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
So this report covers many aspects of kids' health in North Texas, everything from rates of diabetes to how many kids have health insurance to the most common form of STD. Start off, Dr. Tsai, by telling me how healthy overall kids are in North Texas.
You know, we're fortunate in North Texas to have a generally healthy patient population, child population. I think what this report aims to do, though, is to be able to illustrate where are some opportunities for us to continue to improve the health of our patient population, our children. And I say that we're generally healthy because I think we've largely eradicated a lot of vaccine-preventable diseases. There's still pockets of measles, as you've heard in the news. There's still whooping cough that too often can kill some of the littlest children in our community. But in general, we have access to clean water. We have access to areas for our children to play and run around in. But unfortunately, there's still pockets of North Texas that lack some of those amenities. And I think what this report tries to do is to try to color that and to try to show which areas can continue to improve so that we can have the healthiest children in the United States.
How has the Affordable Health Care Act affected kids in North Texas?
Yeah, so there's been many positive changes that have come about as a result of the Affordable Care Act. One of those has been one-year Medicaid access for our children beginning in 2014. There's still some paperwork you have to fill out and some means testing. But in general, it has been easier for children to stay on Medicaid for longer than 6 months. And what this means is that children can renew their prescriptions, can follow up with their specialists, can follow up with their primary care doctors. And so there's been many positive changes that have resulted from the Affordable Care Act. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of access to care and addressing chronic conditions. But that was a good positive step.
But there were more kids who ended up being able to stay with their prescriptions and to stay with their doctors.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And of course, around 1 million people in Texas actually gained health insurance after the Affordable Care Act. How might the insurance status of parents affect kids' health?
That's a great question. I think for too long, frankly, we in pediatrics as a specialty have focused exclusively on children. And that's what we're here for. But I think what we are beginning to realize more and more is that the health of the family plays such a critical role in the health of that specific child. And I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
Obviously, smoking has been a great example in terms of reducing parental smoking will reduce the risk of having ear infections and asthma in their young children. But we're also looking at how does access to healthier foods for the entire family and access to health care and information about a mom and dad's weight and what their healthy weight and lifestyle should be, how does that affect children? And there's evidence that suggests that since almost half of our children are actually overweight or obese, that's probably the next big social health issue that we need to tackle.
And North Texas in that area scores pretty low, right?
Yeah, we are overweight as a community.
Kids and adults.
Kids and adults. And I think that the way to start is not just to say to the kid that they have to go on a diet, but really the child is going to want to eat with the family and eat what everybody else is eating. And it really does take the entire family, if not an extended family, to eat healthier and to exercise regularly so that they can lead healthier lifestyles.
Now, you mentioned that there are more kids who have health insurance, you've seen in the study this year, especially since the Affordable Health Care Act. But access isn't the same as having insurance. You know, having it doesn't guarantee access. So how are we doing in North Texas in terms of providing doctors for kids, mm-hmm. pediatricians?
That's exactly right. You've hit the nail on the head. We have a lot of families who've frankly jumped through all the hoops that we've put up in front of them. They filled out all the paperwork that we've asked them to fill out. And they have their access to Medicaid or CHIP or to the exchange plans. And they call around and nobody's accepting their insurance. And it's a tragedy because, again, they've done all the right things and put and completed all the steps that we've asked them to fill out. The challenge is there's too few pediatricians and physicians in North Texas who can afford to accept Medicaid and CHIP in their practices. The blessing and the curse of being in North Texas is that we have a wonderful, strong economy. We're bringing in a lot of new jobs and a lot of new folks into North Texas. They're working for some of the major employers. And so the pediatricians that are there are busy, more than busy, taking care of kids on commercial insurance. And so what Children's Health has done over the past 15 years is to create and expand a network of primary care pediatric practices. These are doctor's offices that provide care to children on Medicaid, CHIP, as well as commercially insured and certainly accept cash as well for those who are uninsured. And they provide the same range and breadth of pediatric services that you would typically expect in a private practice, if you will, realizing that a lot of these families, they've been calling around and they've been calling their Medicaid managed care plans, and there's simply no doctors who are accepting new patients. And so we are busy. We've taken care of a million patients since we opened in 2000, and our rate has increased so that we'll hit our second millionth patient in about 3 to 4 years.
Wow. So it does seem like a similar problem some adults face as well, in terms of there are lots of doctors, there are lots of physicians in this area. So it's confusing because there's not necessarily an overall shortage, but there's a shortage of doctors who accept certain types of insurance.
Absolutely. And there's also unequal distribution if you look at South Dallas, there's not a lot of pediatricians in South Dallas. There's a few, but not enough for that patient population. If you look in North Dallas, they're where you might expect them to be, but they're not in some of the lower income communities of North Dallas.
Now, in the report, you highlight that seeing the same pediatrician is actually important for a kid's health.
Yeah, absolutely. I think many of us, not all of us, but many of us were fortunate to have a physician, pediatrician, family practice physician, generalist, if
you will. A lot of us remember their names even when we're older.
Absolutely, that we remember seeing year after year. And you can't speak too much of that, of the benefit of that continuity. When I see the patients that I've seen year after year, I have an immediate understanding of their family, of their healthcare status, even without looking in the chart. Having said that, we do have an electronic health record that's shared across our organization. And so if I'm seeing you for the first time and you've been here before, I have the benefit of all of your lab data and your previous diagnoses. But seeing that same face year after year, visit after visit, you really develop that rapport with that family, and you're able to tease out some of those diagnoses that might otherwise be more challenging to pick up.
Now, Dr. Partap, you work with kids, and you work with kids especially in the foster care system. I imagine continuity isn't something that is easy to develop with doctors especially.
You know, so at Children's, we're lucky. We have two clinics dedicated to children in foster care through the Reese Jones Center for Foster Care Excellence. And we actually seek out that same continuity. So for that 12 to 18-month period that you are taking away from your parents, we try really hard to make sure children become to trust us. They can see the same person each time and build a relationship there as well. When we happen to see one of the children that used to be in one of Dr. Tsai's practices, we actually refer them back there so that they have that same familiar face and bonding that can carry them through this really tough time.
And I've always found it interesting that Children's, for kids, and we actually mentioned this in a show yesterday about the history of Parkland and Children's, that for kids who start at Children's for a certain chronic condition, they come back sometimes as adults too. Yeah.
Absolutely. We have, over the past 102 years of our history at Children's, I would say millions of success stories. And it's really rewarding when one of what we call our NICU graduates, or the children who are in our NICU, come back, or a patient who had a complex congenital heart disease, they come back as adults, or some of our patients who have survived cancer.
But I mean, sometimes they come back for actual treatment as well, instead of going to a hospital that is just full of adults.
Absolutely. That's one of the nice things about taking care of kids, is that you do get to see them through from birth to 18. And there are certain conditions that children's hospitals, because we perform the surgery or we know that condition better than anybody else, and quite frankly, because a lot of these children didn't historically survive through adulthood, that really pediatricians and pediatric experts and specialists are really the best people to take care of these kids even as they become adults.
Yeah, because what's interesting, right, is that we're raising future parents.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the report in terms of generations, then the better job we do now, then hopefully when they're parents, they will feel better equipped, better prepared, more supported by their communities for their children to be healthier. And we do see families who reluctantly leave their pediatric practices, and that bridge over into adult health care is really important for a lot of the reasons cited in this report.
Now, the Latino population in the U.S. and, of course, in Texas has been steadily growing. In Dallas County, I think that there are about 1 million Hispanic residents, and some of those people and some of the parents speak Spanish at home. How difficult is it to find bilingual pediatricians?
Yeah. Spanish-speaking physicians are more scarce, obviously, because it does – you don't want somebody who just speaks Spanish un poquito, right? It's very challenging to be able to speak to any families, even in English, and try to pick up what's going on in that family. And to have folks who kind of speak very minimally doesn't really fully meet the needs of those patient families. And so we've been very deliberate in trying to reach out to identify physicians who have, if not fluent, near fluency in Spanish language and other languages as well, as we try to serve the diverse patient populations in North Texas.
So when kids do go to the pediatrician or come to you in, here in Texas, what are the most common illnesses that you see beyond the flu or the cold?
Yeah. So that's a good question. So you're right. Most of our visits are, you know, runny noses, sore throats, ear infections and whatnot. I would say some of the more serious conditions that we see that are more chronic would include asthma, would include diabetes, both the form where you are using insulin and is typically diagnosed at a younger age, but then also the diabetes that sadly we're seeing in some of our teenagers who are obese and largely a result of insulin resistance. And so insulin in itself doesn't typically take care of it like a insulin-dependent diabetic would. But then also that's really driven by the tremendous rates of obesity that we're seeing in our children.
So have you seen that rate change much over time, or those conditions, which ones, the chronic ones that people are coming in for, change over the past, I think, 14 years you've done the study?
I think one of the sort of alarming changes is the increase in diagnosed mental illness. So one in five of our school-age children meet criteria for a mental illness, whether they're receiving treatment or not, but that's the symptoms that they describe to people who are asking them. 13% of children covered by Medicaid are prescribed psychiatric medication. The report shares that 15% of our children have chronic disabilities. So the better job we do in our NICU period and in those early years, we do have children who are living longer with disabilities, and we don't see kids in our neighborhoods outright that have disabilities as often as we should or as often as they live. And so they're kind of hidden populations, I think, both of those. Obesity, definitely. We think of obesity as a weight issue, but it's not. It's a very serious chronic medical condition where the injury to your body systems begins as early as age 8 or sooner. And if we don't change that trajectory right away, you're looking at the adult who's going to suffer for a long time as well.
It's really unfortunate because I think there's an idea that, oh, okay, I'll lose the weight at some point, or when I'm a teenager, or I'll grow out of it, or so on. And you're saying that doesn't solve the problem necessarily.
No, it'd be like letting a rash fester on your face and saying, I'll get to it later. Like the time has to be today for any chronic condition, including obesity.
Wow. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about kids' health in North Texas, a report card on kids' health. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back with more from Drs. Ray Tsai and Anu Partap after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about a new report on the health of children in Dallas County and North Texas. Here in the studio, Dr. Ray Tsai, President and Chief Medical Officer of Children's Health Pediatric Group, and Dr. Anu Partap, who's Director of the new Reese, or I guess it's not so new anymore, but the Reese Jones Center for Foster Care Excellence at Children's Medical Center. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Now, Dr. Tsai, there's a somewhat surprising difference in the overall population of kids in Dallas County versus Collin County, or at least it surprised me. Whereas Collin County's child population increased quite a bit, Dallas's dropped. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think that's the result of the development that you're seeing in Collin County. I think Dallas County is as we all know, many pockets are becoming more and more expensive to continue to live there. One of the challenges of living in Dallas County, I might add, is that unfortunately, it has the highest rate of children living below the poverty line of any great American city. Any city more than a million folks, Dallas City leads the nation in terms of the percentage of children who are living under the poverty line. What you are seeing across Collin County and Denton County is really a lot of those land deals and a lot of the new houses that are coming up. A lot of folks are moving to the Prospers and the Salinas and Annas and Melissas of Collin County.
So what do you do as a pediatrician when you're seeing kids who I would imagine their health is greatly impacted by the fact that they are living in poverty? What can you do?
Absolutely. And that's a struggle that we have as a pediatric institution, as a pediatric society, if you will. I think we've done a nice job. Dr. Partap can speak to some of the challenges within the foster care population, which are unique and I would say more severe. But within general pediatrics, I think we've done a nice job. And we can stop to take a breath and to pat ourselves on the back, but we're not done yet in terms of preventing those vaccine-preventable illnesses and preventing injuries in childhood, which are still a leading cause of death in children. And we are getting better to understanding and fighting against cancers and other serious conditions. I think the next step is to say, okay, our children are alive. They're out of the NICU. They're developmentally appropriate. How are they going to be successful as young adults and into adulthood? And we actually had a symposium earlier today where we worked with other nonprofit leaders throughout North Texas to identify ways that we could all work more collaboratively together. And I'll give you an example of a situation where we're taking care of children throughout 20 practices in North Texas. And at one of our practices at St. Philip's, which is a great school and community center at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in South Dallas, we had a child come in recently with his siblings, and he complained that his feet hurt. As a physician, you kind of start asking the questions, well, how long have your feet hurt? What makes it better? What makes it worse? Do you remember somebody maybe stepping on your feet, or did you have an injury to your foot? Do you have any other symptoms, fever, infection, other sorts of things? And in general, the answer was no to a lot of these. And so when the physician looked at the feet, they were kind of curled upon each other because the kid's shoes didn't fit. And really, that was just such a tragedy in terms of a child, trying to go to school, probably not able to pay attention because their feet are cramped in their shoes, and then coming to the doctor's office. And most doctor's offices, unfortunately, wouldn't be able to really treat that beyond saying, hey, mom, dad, you need to get new shoes for your kids. But obviously, mom and dad already knew that. The nice thing about having a practice that's at St. Philip's is that there's a clothes bank right on campus. And so we're able to direct that family to be able to access the shoes that kid could wear so that they could be successful in school. That wasn't a very expensive intervention. That wasn't an MRI. That wasn't a shot. That was really an example where we need to partner with other folks, other community leaders already in the trenches, if you will, taking care of our patients and work more collaboratively with them so that we can identify these are the number of children that we need and we expect to be seen. These are some of the resources that they need access to. Well, how can we work together to make sure that they get those resources so that they can be successful?
Now, you work in different parts of the community, and I imagine from that story that it's also really important, not just your medical training, but some sort of cultural understanding and just awareness.
Absolutely. I have the privilege of working across all 20 of our practices, and it really is a unique privilege to be able to see the history and the culture of many of the neighborhoods that we serve, everywhere from Oak Cliff to Cockrell Hill to Pleasant Grove to Lake Highlands and our many suburban locations as well. I would say that one of the benefits that we have as a physician practice being part of Children's is an integrated behavioral health program that has social workers to help us identify whether it's everything from rent assistance or transportation, but also, as Dr. Partap mentioned, a lot of the serious mental health concerns that are addressing our patients and their families and are preventing them from leading healthy, successful lives.
You're listening to Think on KERA. If you've found ways to keep your kids healthy in North Texas or have questions about health for children in this area, join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Now, Dr. Partap, tell me a little bit about what you do with foster children in the area.
So it's an extension of much of what Dr. Tsai has explained. So when pediatricians see that there's communities of children who have unique needs, whether it's low income or they're overweight, in our case it was that they were survivors of abuse and neglect, and that the abuse and neglect came from their parents, we realized that for that subset of children who enter foster care, they really needed health care to look and feel different, that it had to be integrated with CPS and mental health, that we support foster parents, that we support their parents who want their kids back. And so with Children's, we were able to reach out to our community partners, the Reese Jones Foundation, Meadows Foundation, a whole host of other philanthropists who came together and said, we're going to redesign the way we take care of children in North Texas and be a leader in the state. And we've started doing that, and we're really excited about some of the results that we're seeing with our kids.
How did you redesign it, or what's the biggest change?
So the biggest change is, I think, pediatrics, well, all of healthcare is really reactive, right? You show up, we ask you what's wrong, we treat it, send you on your way, come back if, you know, it doesn't work, right? But what we're doing is we look at the science, and we're saying, okay, if you have been abused, neglected, you're living with chaos, and you're only the 20 to 30% of victims who enter foster care, we know that that substantially changes the way your body functions, that chronic stress changes your brain, and that those changes in your brain response to stress actually changes your risk for infection, your risk for disease, and it affects your entire body's response maybe for years. So what we're doing now is we're saying let's intensively treat abuse and neglect and chaos the way you would cancer or spinal cord injury, that you receive intense support and intervention from day one and that it stays with you and that we make sure that you're actually recovering in a family and community that can support you.
Wow, that sounds very different and intensive, like it's a lot of work. How have the numbers changed in terms of kids in North Texas who have to go into the foster system or suffer from abuse or neglect?
So our region is made up of about 19 counties, and we have about 7,000 children living in foster care. The six counties in this report counts for 4,000 of the 7,000 wow. children. You always have to look at population growth. Unfortunately, Dallas County is outpacing the number of children who are moving here. So we have more children entering foster care each year above and beyond our population growth. So there's a definite increase in the number of kids that we need to take care of and think about that really require a unique set of services and care.
Now, Dr. Tsai, the report also shows that the number this year of unintentional deaths of children, I mean, that fluctuates, but it's in Dallas County a total, I think it says, of 53 kids in 2013 died. Collin County had 19. Are the numbers this year any different?
I think we're going to expect to see numbers in those ranges. They're large, but they're relatively small numbers, and so unfortunately they can vary year by year. The alarming part of that number is that those are unintentional and frankly preventable, that a lot of the education that we provide our parents, it's very easy to say, lock up your medicines, make sure that your child doesn't go swimming when there's no adult around. But the challenge is we know that some of that does exist. Well, how do we overcome some of those challenges? Is that through increased pool safety? Is that through some programs such as the Y, where they go out to teach folks at apartment complexes how to swim so that they can be safe when we were all teenagers once, right? They're going to go sneak around to the pool and go swimming. So how can we ensure that we reach those kids before they do that and hopefully teach them skills that will save their life?
Now, what about the disparities you see among counties in terms of kids' health? What do you, where do you see the biggest disparities?
Yeah, there are many disparities across the counties, and as you might, but unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective, they're not as large as what we might think. We've historically thought that, you know, Dallas County is more urban; it's going to have more challenges. But unfortunately, Denton and Collin County, despite being some of the most affluent and fastest growing counties in the United States, suffer as well. And I'll give you an example. We have a practice that's within walking distance of the Shops at Legacy, some of the highest rent districts in all of the country. And yet at that practice, we still have 80% of our patients have Medicaid, CHIP, or are uninsured. And why? Well, unfortunately, health insurance is still very expensive. If you're eligible for – if you exceed the maximum thresholds for assistance, let's say you're a family of four making $50,000 a year. Are you going to put $5,000 toward commercial health insurance? I think that's rather expensive, and I think that's for 10% of your gross income, that may be frankly unreasonable. And so a lot of those families are better off on Medicaid and CHIP financially. And ultimately, those communities are better off because those kids are getting the care that they need. Those are the same kids that, you know, we're all going to school with. Those are the families that are in our communities that we're walking in the mall in. And so if we can make sure that everybody gets their vaccinations and we can make sure that they have their flu vaccine, I'll put in the plug for that right now this time of year. If we can make sure that those kids get their flu vaccines just like my kids do, then ultimately we're all better off because we don't have the flu saturating our schools and our workplace as well. But we're also better off because that community is healthier. For every day that mom or dad is able to stay at work because their kid was treated in a time-appropriate manner and that kid is back in school because they're not suffering from two or three, four, five extra days of the illness, that child is better off learning and that family's financially healthier as well. And we believe that translates down the road into healthier communities.
You can join our conversation about kids' health in North Texas by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Let's go to Jessica in Rowlett.
Hi. I'm a pediatric speech pathologist, and I work all over the Dallas area. And recently there's been proposed cuts to Medicaid, and I looked specifically at, like, therapy services for speech, occupational, and physical therapy, but in addition, there's been cuts to all sorts of health services, and I just wanted to know what kind of impact those proposed cuts might have on the children of North Texas.
Thanks, Jessica. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, Jessica, thank you for your call and for what you do. We definitely, on the front line, are already seeing challenges with finding speech therapists, physical therapists, occupational therapists, particularly for our children who are covered by Medicaid, because of the coming cuts. And so it's already rippling to children who are really at a vulnerable age, that 0 to 5 age group, not being able to receive timely access to needed services right away.
Yeah, so that's a big concern.
It's a very big concern, and we're here with you with that concern.
So there's another comment that we received from someone named Daisy. She says she's a mother of two and an ER nurse, and she sees a lot of patients who check into the ER expecting antibiotics for everything, including viral illnesses. And her question is about whether this is a big concern. The CDC says it's a concern about overprescribing antibiotics. And how have you seen that trend change over the past few years, Dr. Tsai?
That's a great question. Thank you, Stacey, for that comment. We have been very proactive within our physician groups about monitoring our antibiotic prescription rates. The reason for that is manyfold, but one of them is, frankly, that antibiotics aren't necessarily safe and healthy for children. We actually have evidence that the more antibiotics that your child takes over their lifetime, the more likely they are to become obese. We believe that's probably a change in some of the gut flora over time as a result of those antibiotics. But antibiotics are not necessarily a good thing. And one of the things that we've done within our group is to actually monitor our antibiotic prescription rate. And so that if we have different providers within the same practice who have different prescription rates, we go back and try to look at, is there a way to be more consistent? But, you know, it's very important to realize for all the parents out there that antibiotics are important for those diseases that are bacterial and can benefit from antibiotics. But there's a lot of diseases out there that look like a bacterial infection but are typically viral in nature. And those diseases will get better despite antibiotics.
Yeah, it's an interesting concern for both parents and adults.
Yeah, because it's hard to sit for 3 or 4 hours in an emergency department and then see someone and leave with nothing.
Oh, yeah.
But leaving with a viral diagnosis is great. And, you know, you can just be happy that that's what all your child has and needs lots of TLC.
Now, quickly, some cities are trying to promote healthy lifestyles, and most notably in Fort Worth, Mayor Betsy Price's Blue Zones initiative, I've heard some about. Do you think that that could have any significant impact, a citywide initiative?
Absolutely. I think we all need to get up and exercise more and to have opportunities where we as a collective group, whether that's your block, whether that's your entire neighborhood, subdivision, city, things like that that can motivate us to get up and walk around and to exercise a little bit, those will go a long ways toward ensuring that our children aren't as obese as this population is, as our current population is. And that's important because, unfortunately, we're seeing children with not only diabetes as a result of obesity. We're seeing that they need a CPAP, which is that machine that people wear at night to basically push air into their lungs so that they can breathe and they don't have sleep apnea at night. That's scary. To have a 10-year-old who's unfortunately obese for a variety of reasons, sometimes it's medically induced, but they have unfortunately such a degree of sleep apnea that they need a machine to push air into their lungs. That's a child who's going to develop other comorbidities and who's going to have liver and other issues, heart issues as well. And so to the extent that we can try to encourage people to exercise more, exercise safely. It's North Texas, so yes, it's hot in the summertime. But if we can walk collectively as a family or as a collective unit in the morning time before it gets too hot, those are the steps, if you will, that we all need to take, that Dallas needs to take to hopefully be healthier.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman sitting in for Chris Boyd. This hour, a report card on kids' health in North Texas. You can join our conversation. Call 800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman and we'll be back with more from Drs. Ray Tsai and Anu Partap after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. This hour, we're talking about a new report on the health of kids in Dallas County and North Texas. Here in the studio, Dr. Ray Tsai, President and Chief Medical Officer of Children's Health Pediatric Group, and Dr. Anu Partap, Director of the Rees Jones Center for Foster Care Excellence at Children's Medical Center. Let's talk about some of the recommendations in the report, because it's not just a ton. There's good news and there's bad news and so on, but there are recommendations. What are some of the top recommendations, Dr. Tsai?
Yeah, I think we need to do more to address some of those structural issues that are affecting our children. Again, we've done a decent, not thorough, not complete job within health, but we also need to do more around, frankly, a lot of the inequalities in living standards and also in economic security that are affecting our children. What this report addresses in those different categories is some of the access to child care, some of the access to high-performing schools. What are our rates of school performance within the different counties as well? Again, we can raise generally healthy children nowadays, but if we don't have those other structural needs within the community set up for them, again, education, housing, access to healthy foods, we're going to raise a generation that's not going to achieve as high as they really should. And without really balancing our efforts across all of those domains, we're really not successfully going to see the results of our investments in just one of those categories.
How about Dr. Partap? What do you see as recommendations for kids, especially kids who are perhaps the most vulnerable, who are in the foster care system?
You know, for our kids in foster care, they really sort of teach us. They're the canaries in the coal mine, right? So they're teaching us about the rest of the children in our community. They're in some ways the lucky ones, where someone recognized that they were being harmed and we give them full support. And I think in looking at what their needs are and their parents' needs are, it's alarming to think of the food insecurity in our community for it to be 20 to 25% of families don't know where their next meal is coming from. So North Texas Food Bank becomes very important. Our early childhood communities, this morning we got to meet with the Commit folks, and being able to make those links is the only way to really help families raise their children. You know, healthcare is this one small piece of the puzzle. And usually when families come to us, they already know what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. And so in foster care, it's the same thing. Foster parents already know what their kids need. Our job is to help them find what they need and help it be accessible. So food, early education, Ray talked about the economic indicators. I think the big thing that we sometimes miss supporting our parents with is helping them receive what they say they need. So when you're talking to a single parent with three children who's working two jobs, and we tell them, we need you to go to this special rec center three times a week, like, it's not going to happen, right? Yeah. So being able to link communities based around this report and this data is really what we need to do next.
Actually applying the recommendations and not just a blanket recommendation. It's probably important as well. Yeah. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Let's go to Gene in Dallas.
Hello.
Hi, Gene. How are you doing?
Not bad. Earlier on, you had asked the doctors about language, a cultural aspect, and that part of that was language. And I was wondering if their facility uses a language line to ensure that they communicate with other languages effectively, whatever the health concerns might be about their child.
Great question.
Absolutely. We use a language line that has, I think, hundreds of languages. There are, though, beyond language, I think there's also a growing sense that we need to understand, I think, as one of the folks this morning at the symposium when we released our Beyond ABC report eloquently said it, we need to understand where those words come from. Where those words from that foreign language come from.
Not the root origin, the Latin or the Greek. You're not saying that much.
Right. But what is the cultural context of those words? Because it's very easy for us to translate simple statements and simple needs via a language line. But, you know, what are the origins of that word? What's behind the simple four or five letter words?
Can you give an example of that? I'm curious.
I think, especially in pediatrics, you might appreciate that parents obviously always want the best things for their child, and so we often have a lot of families who come in who say, you know, my kid is crying, my kid is sick, and I might look them over and say, well, biologically, your kid looks okay. They're afebrile. They look like they've gained some weight. They don't have any signs of any overt infection. That's okay. Good job, mom. You know, everything's fine. But there's probably a reason why that mom came in. And if you just translate word for word, you're going to miss those subtle cues and signals that mom is giving you. Maybe there's, you know, domestic violence at home. Maybe there's a concern about the child's performance in school. Maybe there's a concern about where their next meal is coming from. And if you don't really stop and think about where those words are coming from, why that question might have been posed, you're going to miss a lot of those. And again, you know, that was in an era maybe 20, 50 years ago when you were worried about children dying from epiglottitis and infections like that.
Appendicitis. Yeah.
That, you know, you maybe missed some of those. But nowadays, we really owe it to our patients that we need to pick up on those cues, because that's just as important nowadays as appendicitis and meningitis. It's important to pick up on those social needs as well, behavioral health needs that are so prevalent in our patient population as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for families who don't speak the same language as their providers, they really need to feel the power to insist on someone who speaks their language before they begin receiving the service. And if that place can't meet their language needs, it's a safety issue. They really need to find a place that can communicate with them in the language of choice, but then also that other language as well. So.
Now, Dr. Tsai, the report also covers how North Texas counties, six of them, are doing in terms of teen and child pregnancy. How are we doing this year?
I think overall we've made some improvements.
Because it had been pretty bad in years past.
It had been pretty bad. And in Grayson County, I think one of the highlights is that teen births have dropped in Grayson County. The challenge is, I think every one of these births and frankly every one of these infections was a missed opportunity in terms of us helping our teenagers lead healthier lives. And obviously the statistics show that children born to teenage mothers aren't economically secure as children who are probably born to mothers who are in their 20s or 30s.
And then that economic insecurity can lead to health issues.
And frankly, in some ways, it's passed down from generation to generation. And so each one of those is really an opportunity for us to talk seriously with our teenagers. What I tell my teenagers is basically, I don't trust any of you.
I'm sure that's very comforting to them.
And so I say, you know, despite what you may have told, you know, told me that you know or don't know, I'm going to give you, you know, the lowdown from A to Z. It might take a little bit more time in our exam rooms, but it's important to me that I've been able to share what every teenager needs to know, so that they're not, you know, learning it from their classmates or hearing things on the internet that may or may not be true. And so it's important for us to really spend the time with our teenagers and to give them the facts, give them the truth. So that we can hopefully continue to see a reduction in teenage births and obviously in sexually transmitted diseases as well.
Now, Children's has been doing some work trying to help with access to medical care. And I've seen telehealth as one possible, not solution, but one way to help. What's going on with telehealth and telemedicine?
Yeah, absolutely. So in addition to our 20 physical children's health pediatric locations, in addition to Dr. Partap's and the Reese Jones Foundation Centers of Excellence for Foster Care, having two different campuses in Plano and also in Dallas, we also realize that, frankly, bricks and mortar are fairly expensive. And so a few years ago, we reached out to students, to patients, where they spend most of their time, which is in school. Yeah. And so we work in partnership with school nurses to help us identify those kids with that rash that developed in school, that fever, that pink eye, things that we can safely address over telemedicine. And this is the beauty of it. Those kids are more likely to stay in school. And so instead of, frankly, they'll call mom to pick up the kid at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and say, hey, little Johnny has pink eye. You need a school note. You need a note from your doctor before they can come back to school because they don't want that germ to spread. And what does that mom typically have to do? Well, it's 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. By the time they pick them up, they're going to go to the local emergency room and wait for hours for pink eye or scabies or something simple. Instead, they power up the HIPAA secure telecommunications equipment, talk to one of our doctors or nurse practitioners, and we can safely diagnose many conditions and then e-prescribe medicine so that that mom who's on the phone can know that when she goes to pick up her son or daughter at the end of the day, they can go swing by the pharmacy, pick up their medications. They have an after visit summary. They have a summary that's sent to their pediatrician or family practice physician, and they're able to start taking care of those conditions immediately. And there's actually evidence to show that if you start your antibiotics for strep throat, for instance, you're safe to go the next morning to school. Mm. And so that child is now able to go to school the next morning safely.
Sorry, kids.
And learn. Yep, that's right. No more free out-of-school passes. And that parent's back at work. Yeah. That beautiful thing. And it prevents a costly ER visit as well.
So how many schools are trying this sort of experiment? I guess you're seeing how it goes.
Yeah. So we started small with a few programs, but at this point we're over 50, and we're targeting almost 100 different school campuses as well, working with those school nurses who know those kids and who know what they need. And we're trying to address things like asthma. There's too many kids who go to school without the right inhalers and without the right education on how to prevent their asthma from flaring up. And nobody knows these kids better than those school nurses. And so we're really fortunate to partner with these nurses to be able to provide that education and, frankly, access to high-quality care.
Now, what's really exciting about this, though, is that what Ray is describing is that they redesigned healthcare to meet what the community needed, right? And so for anybody out there who's hearing this story, think about how do you apply this technology, this type of healthcare design, to any other health problem that's in this report or that you know is happening in your neighborhood. We took that exciting story and decided that kids in foster care, when CPS first picks them up at 2 or 3 a.m., needs that same access right away to know, does this child who looks like they're sick or has this bag of medication, I don't know what it's for, can maybe talk to a physician or nurse right away instead of waiting until that child finally makes it into a clinic.
Oh, is that how it works now? So if how is the process of intervention and medical care for kids who are picked up from their families?
So right now it's up to the CPS worker to not only assess whether that child can safely stay there or has to leave, also make sure that the family is communicated with and that they receive information from them, then see if that child needs access to health care right away or not, find them a home that exact same night, fill out lots of paperwork so that this is legally the right way to do this, which is an absolutely impossible set of tasks. So right now, unfortunately, Texas allows children up to 30 days before they have to have that initial child abuse neglect assessment or any kind of health screening, 30 days,
wow,
which is far below national standard, of up within 72 hours. So most large states require a visit within 24 to 72 hours. We are working really hard on narrowing from 30 days to 72 hours.
That's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. But one of the issues is, what is the right timing? The timing needs to be based around how that child looks, not some artificial number of days or hours. What's exciting about maybe a telehealth opportunity is that CPS workers have cell phones with FaceTime. So could they call someone and receive help right then and there if a child is limping, if a child doesn't look right, if they can't breathe because their asthma medications are out? Our kids in foster care have chronic conditions 3 to 5 times higher rates than their peers. So you're more likely picking up a child who does have health issues than not.
And at that point, I imagine as the CPS worker, you're sort of making a decision of, can this wait up to a month or does it need ER treatment right now? And it's sort of one or the other.
That's right. And then when CPS has that really tough decision along with like 20 other tasks,
yeah,
I mean, their jobs are just incredible. I think what also can happen is then it's transferred to the foster parent who has even less information. And so when someone tells you you have up to 30 days, you think that's probably safe, right?
Yeah.
And so when they happen to call a clinic, that's when we can start to tell them over the phone, actually, it'd be great to see them sooner because that bruise might represent something internally that needs a specialist.
Now, Dr. Tsai, we don't have a ton of time, but what is the best recommendation that overall you can give to parents trying to keep their kids healthy in North Texas? What's the easiest and most effective recommendation?
That's a great question. I think it's really to talk to your children every day, every night, all the time. Have a non-judgmental conversation with your child, whether they're 2 years old, 5 years old, or 15 years old. At 2 year old, because that's when their language development is starting. And so they'll be able to learn new words and be able to understand phrasing and inflection and hopefully use those words back to you. When they're 5 years old, because they're starting to read and they want to tell you about things. And when they're 15 years old, because really that's the time where they don't need a friend. I have too many parents who want to be their 15-year-old's friend. They don't need a friend. They need someone to set boundaries for them. And honestly, they know that you care about them when you tell them no and when you go out of your way to sometimes make life more difficult for them.
Dr. Ray Tsai and Dr. Anu Partap, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Lauren.
Both doctors helped put together Beyond ABC, assessing the well-being of children in Dallas County and North Texas Corridor. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knabe. Lindsay Knecht is associate producer with help on the phone from Gus Contreras. And you can get in contact with us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.